It's my pleasure to introduce now Rabbi Francis Nataf. Rabbi Nataf is a very respected educator and thinker and writer. He's well known for his ability to find new ways of looking at Jewish texts and tradition, for his willingness to confront the community and its problems head on. He's the author of two books, which I hold in front of me. Redeeming Relevance is the title of both books. One is on the book of Genesis, one on the book of Exodus, as well as numerous articles for a variety of important Jewish periodicals and websites. Won't you please welcome Rabbi Francis Nataf.
Thank you, Elliot. It's a pleasure to be here with you this morning. I always enjoy coming to Toronto in February. It's an unusual pleasure. I'm coming from Israel. But in truth, I enjoy speaking for Torah in Motion. It's one of these organizations that I can identify with, and it's on some level of speaking to people in Boston, New York. It's become an institution of international fame, so it's really a pleasure to be involved with them here today, this morning. I am here on a speaking tour, and partly it's to promote my latest book, which is on Shemot, which is on Exodus, the blue book that Professor Malamet showed you, which is also on sale at the front and in the back. And unfortunately, what happens, I'm quoting Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, that when you do these sort of things, you end up saying over in poor English what you work so hard to write in good English. But you'll excuse me for doing that. I mean, obviously, the upside of an oral presentation is that it's live and there's give and take. And so if it's not as eloquent as in the written form, at least there are its advantages as well. So this is actually based on a chapter in the latest book called, I don't know exactly what it's called, but something to the effect of Moshe's stutter, the pardonable sin. I think it's exactly the name of the chapter. It's not exactly the name of the presentation today, but both basically the same idea. Now, I've always personally been fascinated by Moshe's first discussion with God. I don't know how many of you have looked carefully at that particular section of the first parsha in Sefer Shemot, in the book of Exodus. And when you think about its place, not only in Moshe's career, but in the strictures and annals of the Jewish people, it really is quite surprising what goes on. In other words, what I'm saying is Moshe Rabbeinu is the quintessential Jewish hero. There's no one who's been like him in terms of his closeness to God, and presumably that's what Judaism is all about. So he is unprecedented, and he's the hero of the Jewish people in the sense that no one else can be. And yet, the first encounter with God is surprising on a number of counts. If this is the man who is going to set the tone for Jewish spirituality, one might expect a sense of awe and fear and trepidation in front of God. And in fact, when we look carefully at the discussion, one sees quite the opposite. This rancor and argument, and this we're going to look at today. We're going to look carefully at that particular discussion in the book of Shemot. And I'm going to invite you, as we look over some of the key psukim, there are chumashim in the back, and I should have said that at the very beginning. I'll let you take a break now to grab a chumash in front of you. Those of you who want to listen without looking inside, you're welcome to do so. But we will do quite a bit of work inside the text. So I highly recommend taking a chumash. Okay, I'm not sure if there's enough. You can share with the neighbor. Okay, we're going to look at a few verses in Perek Gimel and Dalet, and then later in Perek Vav. And what I'm going to ask you to do, I'm going to read through the psukim in Hebrew and at least summarize them in English. And as we read through the psukim, I'm going to ask you to look for questions and problems, things that raise our attention, things that seem to be strange. I mean, I'm sure no one here is a stranger to Jewish textual work, so I don't need to explain what I mean by textual questions. Let's look inside, starting in Perek Gimel. This is more by way of introduction. Perek Gimel, Psukim Yud Aleph, Yud Bet. Right, this is the discussion after Moshe sees the burning bush, goes aside to God. So Moshe says as follows, again, Perek Gimel, Pasuk Yud Aleph, chapter 3, verse 11, Ve'yomer Moshe, El Elohim, Mi Anochi, Ki Elech El Paro, Ve'ki Otzi Et Bnei Yisrael Mi Mitzrayim. Who am I that I should take the Jews out, that I should go to Paro, and that I should take the Jews out of Mitzrayim? Ve'yomer, God responds, Ve'yomer Ki Yei Mach, Vezelecha, Leot haot ki anochi shlachticha beotziecha et ha'am Mitzrayim ta'avdun et Elohim al ha'har hazeh. Okay, I'm only interested in the first part of this verse. God says to him, because I will be with you. Okay, we'll skip a little further to verses 17 and 18. The discussion ensues, and you see what's going on. God is trying to convince Moshe that he should fulfill a mission that God has asked him to do, to take the Jews out of Mitzrayim. And Moshe has already told God that he has doubts about this mission. Continuing in verse 17, Pasuk Yud Zayin, V'omar ele etchem me'oni Mitzrayim el eretz Kanani v'aiti v'amori v'prizi v'ahivi v'yusi el eretz v'at halav d'vash. God says to Moshe, I'll go up with you to the land of Canaan, mentioning the nations that live there. V'shamu lekolcha uvata ata v'ziknei Yisrael el melech Mitzrayim v'amartem elav Adonai Elohei Avrim nikra eleinu v'ata nelchana derech shloshit yamim b'midbar v'nizbecha l'Adonai Eloheinu. Okay, God says that the Jews will listen to you. And you'll go up to Paro, and the psukim continue. Paro is not going to listen to you right away. Only later on will he actually listen to you. Okay, let's go on now to the main part of the conversation in the next chapter, Perek Dalet. Okay, I'm looking at Pasuk Aleph. V'ya'an Moshe. By the way, V'ya'an is often understood, certainly in Rashi, following Jewish tradition, that be speaking a loud voice, right? Vayan, we normally translate as answering, but answering with conviction. So in any case, Vayan Moshe, Vayomer, Vehen lo yaminu li, velo yishmo ubikoli, ki omru, lo nira elecha Adonai. Moshe is speaking about the Jews at this point, and he says to God, they're not going to believe me. Or yaminu here is better translated as trust. They're not going to trust me, and they're not going to listen to my voice, because they'll say that God did not, in fact, appear to you. That's what the Jews are going to say. Looking further in the main part of the discussion, verses 10 through 16, Yud through Tet Zayin. Vayome Moshe el Adonai, bi Adoni lo ish dvarim anochi gam mitmol, gam mishilshom, gam me'az debarcha, El avdecha ki kaved pe, kavad pe, uchavad lashon anochi. So Moshe says to God, please, God, I'm not a man of words, not from yesterday, not from 2 days ago, not from before you're speaking to your servant, because I am of heavy mouth and a heavy tongue. Vayomer Adonai elav misam pel adam, umi yasum ilem uchiresh upikeh uiver halo anochi Adonai. Says God, I'm aware that you have a speech problem. I'm the one who takes care of all these things, right? Ve'ata lech ve'anochi yeh impicha vo'eticha asher tedaber. So now, go Moshe, and I will be with your mouth, and I will teach you that which you should say. Vayomer bi Adoni shalach na bi antishalach. Moshe says back to God, bi Adonai, I'm sorry, Vayomer bi Adonai shalach na bi antishalach. God says back to Moshe, Moshe says back to God, please God, send with someone else who you would like to send. Ve'yacharaf Adonai b'Moshe, ve'yomer halo Aaron achicha ha'levi, yadati ki daber yidaber hu, ve'gam hinehu yotze likratecha, ve'ra'echa v'samach b'libo. So God gets angry at Moshe, and he says, well, Aaron the Levite is coming, and he knows how to speak, and behold, he is happy. He's happy to meet, to greet you, etc. V'dibanta elav v'samta et devarim b'fiv v'anochi yeim picha v'im pihu v'oreti etchem et asher ta'asun. Says God, I'll speak to, you'll speak to him, to Aaron, and you'll place words into his mouth, and I'll be with your mouth and with his mouth, and I'll teach both of you that which you should do. V'diber hu lecha el ha'am, v'ayahu yeh lecha lefe, v'ata tiyeh lo le'elohim. Okay, and that means that you in fact should tell him what to say, and he'll be your spokesman, in paraphrased terms. Okay, what questions do people see in this dialogue, the background in Paragimel? What questions come up? Don't be afraid to say the obvious. Yeah. Okay, why does Moshe not think he's having hallucinations? Okay, what else? Anything more textual? Yeah.
Well, the first in general, I mean, that's not an answer to this question. I mean, he's when Moshe says to God, I'm sorry, I just want to get it. When Moshe says to God, me anochi, and he says,
Okay. So it's not, God's not answering the question. He says, who am I? And God says, I'll be with you. Okay. Yeah, go ahead. Right. Okay, so that's good. I didn't translate that part of the verse because I'm not interested in it, but you're right. That's a classical question on that part of the verse, correct. Anything else? Yeah, go ahead. Right, okay. So that's, I'm glad you brought that up. I thought that would be one of the first questions, and I think it is obvious, and that's why I asked for obvious questions. Maybe everybody was afraid to say it, so thank you for saying the obvious question. God tells Moshe Rabbeinu, Moshe Rabbeinu is a serious person, presumably. He says, go and do it. And not only does Moshe refuse, he refuses it in rather strange ways. I mean, I don't know if people picked up. There's many strange things about his answers, so let's focus on that. Anything strike you as difficult in Moshe's answers, in the way he answers God? I mean, you said God wasn't answering Moshe. Was Moshe answering God? What strikes people? Anything? First of all, yeah, go ahead. Okay, well, you can start. Right. So the speech impediment, was that a reasonable response to God? Right. In other words, what was God's answer to Moshe? Moshe says, I have a speech impediment. What does God say to him? I know. Right? In other words, why do you think, you know, I'm God. You know, welcome, let's have a conversation. What else? Anything else? Did you notice, yeah, go ahead. Right. So again, our understanding of God makes it very difficult for us to read. And as again, one can take a counter-contextual reading of this. In other words, there, within the Jewish tradition, we make certain assumptions about the text, a certain religious context, that Moshe had a basic understanding of God, certainly no less than, you know, our 10-year-olds. And obviously, you can take it outside of the Jewish text, Jewish context. For example, Alan Dershowitz does just that. I critique him very briefly in my first book as someone who I think doesn't do a very good job of reading the text. But partly because when you're working outside of any context, you're not working in a reasonable fashion. I mean, what's his name? Fish, no? Not Harold Fish? Stanley Fish, yeah. Stanley Fish, right, correct. Speaks about interpretive communities, right? He's one important scholars of literary criticism. So he overmakes the point, as most brilliant people do. If you have something, if you're brilliant and you have something intelligent to say, usually overdo it and say it too far, where you make it sometimes a little silly. But one very important point that he makes is, and as an aside, I recently read that Nachama Leibowitz had read Harold Fish's "Is There a Text in the Classroom?" and apparently was fond of it. But in any case, he makes the point that a text doesn't stand by itself. There's an interpretive community around it, and there's a way of reading the text. And to try to be, quote-unquote, objective about a text is sort of meaningless, because there's no such thing as an objectivity. So we could say that, yeah, Moshe didn't understand who God was, and therefore simply has no idea that he's all-powerful, and assumes that God can't do anything about his speech impediment. Says, God, we're in a bind, you and I. You want to send me. And, you know, I'd love to do it, but since I have a speech impediment, then presumably you can't do anything about it, so we're stuck, right? So that would be a non-contextual reading. Okay, I'm reading within the Jewish context that Moshe Rabbeinu is a very serious person. I mean, he's the greatest of the Nevi'im. He's having a very elevated interaction with God that consists of an intelligent dialogue, and nonetheless makes claims that if you take them at face value appear to be silly. They appear to be, again, I have a problem and it can't be that it must be you can't do anything about it. That doesn't work. So Moshe is saying things that presumably don't make sense. They don't make sense, by the way, in the context of the dialogue. God says, okay, I heard you, I'll take care of it. What does Moshe say after that? He says, well, the next pasuk, look again, pasuk, Perek Dalet. No, he doesn't say that there. He says, in pasuk Yud Aleph. Right? No, I'm sorry, pasuk Yud Bet. No, pasuk Yud Gimel. Sorry, pasuk Yud Gimel. What does he say? God answered him. What does he say? Send someone else anyways. Right? What kind of answer? Then that's the height of chutzpah, right? God gives you an answer, and you say, "Well, I still don't want to do it." Right? Very strange. By the way, another question. I don't know if you noticed in Perek Gimel, right, the initial intake, that God says to Moshe, "You're going to speak to the Jewish people. What's the Jewish people? How are the Jewish people going to respond?" What does he say over there? They're going to listen. Says Moshe Rabbeinu in the beginning of Perek Dalet, God, I'm concerned, they're not going to listen. Right? Incredible chutzpah. I mean, again, it's to the point that it's almost nonsensical. And if we didn't have such great respect for Moshe Rabbeinu, we would think this is a comical character. This is Haman or Bilam. Right? This is someone who is simply not on top of things. But I think, again, within our context and understanding who Moshe Rabbeinu is, that the text clearly wants us to dig deeper. And I'm going to start with some of the sources that I gave you. I have my own take on this discussion, which I want to share with you. But there are two commentators that lead us in the right direction. I think one more than the other. The first source I want to take you to take a look at, I think, just restates what we just said in a very terse fashion. And that is on the second sheet. I don't think the sources are numbered. In the middle, the Abarbanel. I want you to take a look at the Abarbanel, who actually speaks on it in a different context on Shmuel Aleph in Perek Yud Zayin. Over there, the Abarbanel is dealing with a different issue. The Abarbanel is concerned about Shmuel HaNavi, right, who in a famous discussion is afraid of Saul's wrath and says to God, I'm afraid of going up to anoint David. I'm afraid of Shaul. Right? And all the commentators ask, similar to what they do here, God is presumably able to protect you. If God told you to go and anoint David, He's not telling you to go on a suicide mission. And even if He is, by the way, you still do it. And yet Shmuel has questions and says, what's going to be? Shaul's going to hunt me down and I'm going to be killed. So the Abarbanel says very insightfully that it's very similar to here. I only have the English. You can look in the Hebrew later. He says, this is the quote about Moshe. He says the same thing about Shmuel. He says, our master Moshe said, and how will Paro listen to me? Even though he knew that God's work will come to pass, but he wanted not to have to say explicitly, I don't want to go. As Moshe is not dealing with a rational objection. Moshe does not want to go. And he's trying every trick in the book in order not to go. He's coming up with every possible objection. Right? God said that they're going to listen to you. Well, God, let's re-examine that. Maybe they won't listen to me. Says, no, God says, no, I told you, they're going to listen to you. So he says, okay, I hear. What about the speech impediment? You know, I have this problem. Maybe that's a reason not to go. God says, yeah, I know. We'll take care of it. Don't worry. So Moshe says, you can't think of any more excuses. He says, you know what? Just send someone else. Right? So the Abravanel coherently, I think, picks up on an attitudinal position. It's not a rational position that Moshe is bringing forward. Ergo, and I think the Ramban brings this up also, ergo, the arguments are not rational arguments. In other words, if we try to understand Moshe Rabbeinu as speaking rational arguments, we're not going to get anywhere. Because that's not what's going on here. Right? It's very difficult to make a case, again, contextually, within the context of Jewish tradition, of making a case that Moshe is saying things that make sense, rationally. The Ramban, who's known for his psychological insights, goes further with this approach. And we'll look briefly at his insights. You can read at... I have several larger quotes for you here. You can take a look at them on your own. Most of them are not translated. I'm going to focus on those very small snippets that are translated, which I think bring up the main point that I would like to focus on in the Ramban. In the first page, the first side, the Ramban, again, if you look at the English, this is on Perek Dalet and the conversation about the speech impediment. The Ramban says as follows, again, I'm looking at the English, he says, behold, because of Moshe's great desire not to go, he didn't pray to God that he should remove his speech impediment. Ramban, by the way, this prayer issue is dealing with a different side of the equation. The Ramban says Moshe not only fails to present a cogent argument, he also fails to come up with an obvious solution. In other words, there may be an issue here that when humans have a need, whether that need is of a more personal nature or even of a communal nature, you want to be a good leader for the Jewish people, there's a way to do things. What do? You pray. So the Ramban, Moshe didn't take that possibilities. In other words, from a different perspective, had Moshe been sincere about his objection, had Moshe really meant that I have a problem and I would love to do it, I would love to listen to you barring this problem, then there would have been a different avenue, a different course for Moshe to explore, and he did not. Therefore, the Ramban says it has to do with an attitude. Right, his great desire not to go, which the Ramban spells out a little more clearly in the next source, which is on the next page. Again, I'm going to read in the English from the second line, the last few words. And Moshe's reasons for all of this obstinacy was his great modesty beyond any man on the face of the earth.
so that he couldn't find it in him to aggrandize himself by speaking to the king, or to glorify himself by saying, Hashem sent me, or to glorify himself over Israel by taking them out of Egypt and by being their king. Again, in bold, right, he couldn't find it in him. Right, he simply had some sort of block, some sort of psychological block, or if you don't like the word psychological, some sort of internalization of selfhood that he simply could not overcome. God says, I want this role for you. God knows everything. God knows the right thing for him to do. And Moshe has something that he simply cannot get out of himself. Right? He can't find it in himself. Because I think the Ramban is certainly on the right track in terms of solving our particular discussion here. And he's also hitting on a meta question, a very important meta question. I think there are two meta questions here. Number one, what is to account for this, right, this attitude of tremendous reluctance? So certainly, anava, modesty, is obviously going to have something to do with it. But it goes beyond modesty, in the sense that there's an appropriate place for modesty, and we salute that place. Moshe is a hero because of the modesty. But as we see from the rest of the text, God gets angry. It's not in place. Right? So we have the meta question of what is this obstinacy? Where is this obstinacy coming from? And I would add that, a second question. Before we get to that second question, I want you to look now in Perek Vav. Right, in chapter 6, this time we'll only look at two psukim. After the initial mission fails, they go to Paro, which, if you remember, God had already predicted to Moshe and told him that Paro is not going to listen to you. Moshe is disheartened and wants to get out of the mission. In fact, the Midrash says, very interesting Midrash, says that Moshe kept on saying, okay, God, I tried it, it's not going to work. God says, no, keep trying. So what happens? Moshe tries and, you know, announces and performs a plague through God performs a plague through Moshe, and Paro, as you know, says, "Okay, I'm not going to do what I said, or I'm not going to do the whole thing." So according to the Midrash, what's Moshe's response? "Okay, God, I tried. Can I go now?" Right? It's just like you know, those of you who have young children, right, who don't want to do something, right? "Okay, I did. Can I go? Can I? You know, I did two dishes. Right? You ask your kids to do the dishes." So they do two dishes. Okay, I'm done, right? It's okay? So according to Midrash, I think it's Midrash Rabbah, if I'm not mistaken, Moshe Rabbeinu has this attitude of trying to escape his mission. But in the text itself, in the biblical text itself, I want you to look first at chapter 6, verse 12, right? That's Pasuk Yud Gimel, Yud Bet, rather. Okay, so we said the mission, the initial mission fails. וידבר משה לפני אדוני לאמור, הן בני ישראל לא שעמו אלי, ואיך ישמעני פרעה, ואני ארעל שפתיים. Okay, so all of a sudden we hear a very similar objection, Moshe Rabbeinu. In other words, it's not just that he says it's not working, but he gives a nuance, he gives a reason, we call it nimuk in Hebrew, he gives a reason why it's not working. God, you know, I'm aral sfatayim, which literally is translated as of uncircumcised lips. Now, is that any different than chavad pen, chavad lashon? It may or may not be. It's certainly the same theme. And the Targum translates it the same way. The Targum Unculus understands it's the exact same issue that Moshe is expressing in different ways, which is also interesting. In other words, Moshe wasn't able to get away with it the first time. Again, this is a common trick of people trying to get out of things, right? You know, you did poorly on a test, you try to convince the teacher, and, you know, I was tired that day, and then you come back to him and you say it in a different way. I didn't sleep enough, right? Maybe that'll get him. It seems extremely redundant, and if that weren't bad enough, right, the verse is repeated almost verbatim at the end of the chapter. That would be verse 30, I think. Is that correct? Yes, verse 30. Pasuk Lamed, Veyomer, in same perek. V'yomer Moshe lifnei Adonai hen anir al sfatayim ve'ech yishma elai paro. It's a little different, but basically the same thing. Many commentators, including Rashi, by the way, say it is a repetition of the previous verse. Nonetheless, we know that the Torah does not waste words for it to repeat the notion which we already had understood from Perek Daled is certainly worth our attention. In other words, what I'm suggesting is the Torah creates a motif here around Moshe's speech problems, which I would suggest represents something deeper. Okay, so we had our first meta question, which is what can we account Moshe's tremendous and almost embarrassing reluctance? And the second meta question I would suggest here, after seeing the other verses in Perek Vav, is what in the world is going on with the speech impediment? Right? Why the focus on this? Right? There are presumably any of a number of excuses that Moshe Rabbeinu can give. Right? According to some of the Mefarshim, he's really hoping that God's going to choose Aaron instead. He respects Aaron. Aaron's the firstborn. Aaron had prophecy before he did. So he's campaigning for his brother. So we don't hear that. We don't hear that in the text. Why the redundant focus and obsession, I would say, over the speech impediment? You want to say something? Okay. I don't know. I mean, it's obviously an important observation. In terms of how we're reading the text, it's not going to fit in. So I'm not going to work it in. I'm going to, since we're running out of time, I'm going to ask for, unless it's a clarification, to leave the question for the end. But obviously your point is valid and well taken. In any case, I want now to move on to my own understanding of what's going on. Again, it's based on the direction the Ramban is going in, and focus on the speech impediment per se. My suggestion is based on a reading of many other sources, both in the Chumash itself, as well as in rabbinic literature, in Midrash, in Talmud, and that suggestion is that Moshe's statement of speech impediment is another way of saying, I'm human. Why do I say that? Humanity, certainly when you're in dialogue with God, is state of imperfection. Right? You know, that's precisely how we're created. The goal is to strive towards perfection. A perfect being does not strive towards perfection. Right? Not that I know much about it, but in Kabbalah, that's understood as the whole purpose of creation, is to get a dynamic perfection in the universe as opposed to the static perfection of God. If you don't understand that, I don't either. Put it on the side. But be that as it may, we all have our imperfections. If it's not speech, you know, I wear glasses. Most Jews seem to wear glasses, right? That's also an imperfection. It's simply human nature. And what I understand Moshe Rabbeinu is saying to God is not the problem that I can't speak. The problem is that I'm human. In fact, the Midrash picks up on that again in Perek Daled. This is the Midrash Rabbah. In Perek Daled, in Pasuk Yud Gimel, when Moshe Rabbeinu says, V'yomer bi Adonai, shalach na biyat tishlach. send with the one usually sends. So many understand that we're speaking about Aaron. Send with the person usually send. The Midrash says two other possibilities. It says send with who by the way has been presenting God's word up until now. Two possibilities. Think back. Think to Avraham Avinu. Who's speaking for God? Okay, one is the Malach, and the other is God Himself. Okay? In other words, Moshe's being asked to do, again, you have to think contextually, Moshe's being asked to do something that's unprecedented. Be God's representative. Speak for God. Be God's spokesman. Up until now, God has used Himself or other perfect beings. Right? Malachim are perfect beings. They're limited in their own way, but they're perfect in the function that they have. They do it perfectly. Moshe says, according to the Midrash, I think very appropriately, send the perfect messages have to be sent with perfect messengers. I'm human. I have a speech impediment. I'm not perfect. I can't do it. It's a bizayon. It's an embarrassment for you. If it's not me, it's someone else, and they're also going to be imperfect. Don't go in this direction. It's bad for you, God. And by the way, that is Moshe's line of argument whenever he wants to change God's mind, so to speak, is God, this is bad for you. I'm concerned which is the most effective type of tefillah, right? As the Mishnah says, if you make God's will, He makes your will into His. Right, now vote. Moshe Rabbeinu takes this tack and says to God, I'm not prepared to do this for your sake. This is bad for you. You'll look bad to have this lowly creature with a speech impediment, i.e. a human being, be your spokesman. Not only that, it's emphasized that of all things, not only do you have me be your spokesman in general, but you have me go to Paro, the most glorious and majestic individual in the world. It was recently at the British Museum. And see, the glory of Egypt is especially in contemporary circumstances, right, was very awe-inspiring. And here you have this relatively meek shepherd, as the Ramban describes it, saying, I am God's spokesman. It's laughable, right? This little guy with a speech impediment. And even if he didn't have a speech impediment, what kind of a representation of God's glory is this? I would suggest that that's Moshe's essential issue over here. And as I said, this theme of Moshe's humanity somehow compromising him is a theme that you see in the argument with Korach. It's a theme that you see in his argument with Miriam and Aaron. An angel, generally speaking, would not be questioned. Moshe Rabbeinu is a human. There's room for bias. There's room for all sorts of imperfection. Therefore, he's open to question. The Malachim say the same thing in the words of the rabbis. In the Gemara on Shabbat, I think it's Daf Pechet, famous discussion about the giving of the Torah. So the angels ask God, how can you give the Torah to Yalud Isha? Someone who's born of a woman. Meaning, right, and this is a theme I develop in another chapter, that the bottom line is, no matter how elevated a person becomes, he has at least one connection to other human beings, which compromises him. He's born of parents, of human parents, right? I think that's the move that Christianity tried to get around. Again, there's something serious going on, right? The Malachim, in the Gemara and Shabbat, say the Torah, the Word of God, cannot be given over to imperfect beings. And God has His strategy and says, you know what, I have an idea also, and I think I know what I'm doing. But the point, nevertheless, remains striking. It's a true point, it's a real point. And on some level, there is an important paradox here in using a human shaliach, human messenger, for Dvar Hashem, for the Word of God. Now, I want to look at one last question that you find in your sources, in the Talmud. If you remember, God got angry at Moshe, Right? So take a look at the Gemara in Zvachim. Again, we'll avoid using time that we don't have. So we'll look straight at the English translation, the Gemara in Zvachim. Again, on the second page, it's the second source on that page. First Hebrew, then English. The anger of the Lord was kindled against Moshe. That's quoting the verse. Rabbi Yishuv ben Karcha said, a lasting effect is recorded of every fierce anger. Right? Whenever it says, Haron Af, whenever it speaks about anger in such a context, in such a manner, so there's always a lasting effect. Lasting effect is another way of saying a punishment. Right? We talk about consequences if we're enlightened parents instead of punishments. Right? Same thing. An effect is recorded of every fierce anger in the Torah, but no lasting effect is recorded in this instance. Rishon Bar Yochai has a different idea, again, for your perusal later on, but the notion is fascinating. Right? On some level, it's irritating. Moshe Rabbeinu seems to get away with doing something that's inappropriate. He gets God angry. Again, he says, I'm not doing it. And at the end, remember, according to Rashi, he's quoting another tradition in Chazal, this is an argument that went on for 7 days, which is even more fascinating. The discussion just in the text is difficult enough, but to appreciate that this might have gone on for hour after hour after hour, after day after day after day, is phenomenal. And God, after 7 days, if you will, of arguing with Moshe, finally has enough and says to Moshe, okay, now I'm really angry. Right? So what do you expect when God's angry? Says Rabbi Yishuv ben Karcha, you expect a punishment. You're not listening to me. Right? This is Ratzon Hashem. I'm telling you my will and you're resistant. This is an avera. This is a sin. And yet, we see in the Psukim just the opposite. It's not only that God doesn't punish Moshe, He compromises with Moshe. Makes a deal with him. Says, okay, so you don't want to do it. All right, let's see. Hey, you have Aaron, your brother. He's a good speaker. Let's do it this way. I'll speak to you. You speak to Aaron. Okay, Moshe? Moshe says, okay, yeah, that's much better. Right? And what is going on here? And the expected consequence, as Rabbi Yishuv ben Korcha points out in the Gemara, is completely absent. The punishment of Moshe is completely absent. For the record, Rav Shmuel Yochai, who says that the punishment was that Aaron would share the leadership, is difficult in the sense that that's precisely what Moshe Rabbeinu wanted. So it's difficult to call it a punishment. Perhaps here the language of consequence, roshem in the Hebrew, is more appropriate. But be that as it may, I think this deserves our attention. And within the context of how we've been learning up until now, I think we're able to understand and answer this particular issue. My suggestion is that God was looking for Moshe to fail. And his failure was in fact his success. What do I mean by that? There's certain things that God would have a hard time convincing us of. Let's say God were to speak to us right now. We were convinced that it was really God. And He said, you know what? I want you to jump off the cliff right now. Don't worry about the consequences. Just jump. I don't know if you know the famous Woody Allen joke about that. You know, when a person hears that, so what does he say? He says, you know, anybody else up there? Right, we're hesitant to believe that somehow jumping off the cliff is for our own good. So much so that many of us, I would say, would be petrified to the point that we wouldn't be able to do it. Or, on a more cognitive level, if God were to say to us, you know what, you don't exist. You don't really exist at all. Would we really believe it? I would dare to say that most of us probably would not. For Moshe Rabbeinu, when God asks him to lead the Jewish people and be God's emissary, it's tantamount to God telling us that we don't exist. The repetition over and over and over again about his imperfection, his obsession with his humanity, I would suggest is an internalization of modesty that's so great that even God can't convince him out of it. There's modesty in Moshe's condition in the sense of modesty as a human being. Not in comparison with others, but an understanding of how small in time and place an individual human being is. In a illustration I make in my book, right, the greatest ant. How great can the greatest ant be? And if you think about the difference between humans and ants, the difference between God and humans is only a multiplication thereof. Moshe Rabbeinu and all greats are aware of this perspective. And Moshe has internalized it to the point where he simply is paralyzed in his initial meetings with God. And so, the man who would become so close to God, who would be the greatest man on many levels ever to walk the face of the earth, a man with tremendous religious power, would be in a very dangerous situation indeed. I don't have to mention that the founder of Christianity, either himself or others, was subject to an understandable temptation to associate himself as being more than human. That's a tremendous danger. It's a real danger for people in that position. God wanted to make sure he had the right man for the job. And the only way to do that is to see if he would fail the test, if he would have his own position so greatly internalized that he simply would not be able to listen to God. That, I understand, is why Moshe is not punished. Because his failure is, in fact, his success. That's what God wanted. And by way of continuing the discussion into the rest of Jewish tradition, as I mentioned at the beginning of the session, Moshe's existence, his leadership, is a paradigm for Jewish leadership. The rabbis recognize patterns that exist among the greatest of Jewish leaders, by Avraham Avinu, by Moshe Rabbeinu, by Shaul, by David. We're not going to look at it inside because I want to leave time for questions, but the last source, Midrash Tanhuma, speaks about the modesty that's required in a true Jewish leader. In my first book on Bereishit, I argue that this is precisely why Yosef, who has greater leadership skills than Yehuda, is rejected as a Jewish leader. He's accepted as an Egyptian leader, but he's rejected as the leader of the Jewish people, the Malchut, the throne has to go to Shevet Yehuda. And the default, by the way, fascinatingly enough, the default in Rachel's children is not from Ephraim and Menashe. The only other legitimate king in the Jewish tradition comes not from Yosef's children, but from Benjamin's children. Yosef does not have the right stuff in the Jewish tradition. He's a great politician, which is exactly the problem. The Jewish leader is someone who runs away. And again, this is a theme that's well known and that's illustrated in this particular midrash. The true Jewish leader is one who's aware of his humanity and therefore is aware of his smallness and therefore has the correct approach of what it means to be a human leader, which on some level is a paradox. That there's only one true leadership, that of God who knows the hearts of men. human leadership is necessarily a compromise for a greater purpose. This is what Moshe embodies in his seminal leadership. And this is the paradigm that I think the Torah is trying to communicate to us through this speech impediment. So to review, and then I'll open it up for questions. What we saw is, via close reading, which I think is the whole point of these sessions, is that the Torah focuses, by way of repetition, on a specific theme. One is attitudinal. Moshe is saying things that make him look ridiculous from a simple level, on the one hand, and a specific theme on the other. The physical, what appears to be, though this is a subject for discussion among commentaries, what appears anyways, according to many, to be a physical handicap. The Torah sets up a need for greater investigation. And I shared with you my personal understanding based on the direction started by the Ramban and to a lesser extent the Abarbanel, looking for psychological, personal issues that can help explain what otherwise is very difficult to explain. Taking on the particular direction of Moshe speaking about his imperfection, which is a manifestation of true modesty, of an understanding of humanity vis-a-vis God. And then finally, we summarize by saying that this paradigm created by Moshe Rabbeinu is in fact a useful and important paradigm in the tradition of Jewish leadership in general. Thank you. I'll take questions. Yeah, go ahead. Right, so first of all, Shaul is very clear in the coronation that he actually hides from the coronation. But the classical verses that are used, where Avram says, Anokhi Afar Ve'Efer, I'm just dust, right? David HaMelech, again, assuming his authorship of Tehillim, speaks about Ani Tolat Ve'lo Ish, I'm a worm, right? I think that a close reading of the text shows other examples of that, but we'll leave it at that for right now. Yeah, I think it's an excellent point. The only source that comes to my mind offhand is the Malbim, who explains why Moshe had to be brought up where he was brought up, that he was being trained for leadership, which he could not be trained in his own national context. It's an interesting idea. I think it's certainly correct that Moshe did have it in him. But I think what the commentators are, specifically the Ramban that I mentioned about the meek shepherd, are relating to is the context of this discussion. Whether Moshe had it in him or not, and I think you're right, he probably did have it in him. At this point, this is what he's communicating to God. It's this part of his personality that he's communicating. Any other questions? Good. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Right, right. So I'm not making that claim. I think I don't know if it fits. I think it's a very interesting idea. I don't like to fit in things artificially. I don't think it works with this particular approach, at least in this part of Moshe's life. I think it's there, definitely in Moshe's career. To integrate it with my reading, I think one would have to read it either as very subliminal, as something very much in the back of his mind, or something that he comes to term later on as his career develops, as he separates from his wife, which is something I develop in another chapter. Yep. Okay. Very good. Yeah, last question.
I wanted to get back to your comment about the about not being on the mission, and at the end of the day, what punished, he was rejected. He got a compromised state. Aaron was his partner, and he got rejected. And ultimately, by failing the test, he's passed the test. But my only question is how do you reconcile Rashi's comment that punishment was that Aaron becomes the Kohen, and the potential to lead the people through priesthood was removed from Moshe and his family and goes on to Aaron? To me, that seems like a punishment.
Right, okay, so you're back to Rashi, which is the... Rashi's going with the other opinion, with Shimon Bar Yochai. And it can be viewed both ways, absolutely. On some objective level, the fact that Moshe wants Aaron to share the leadership still is diminishing from him and his children. So I don't think one has to read that. But again, I think it's important what I mentioned to Rabbi Horowitz, to try to make all positions homogenous is artificial. So in this particular discussion, I'm definitely not taking Rashi's approach. Rashi, you know, there are two sides of the argument in Zvachim, and I identify, I think it's a stronger argument, with the first, and Rashi takes the second. I see no reason to try to harmonize those two approaches. Just to remind you, that for those of you who came late, there are copies of my book on sale in the lobby. It's, I think, a worthwhile investment.